I'd like to call the Senate Committee on Healthcare and Veterans Affairs to order. It's a beautiful day in Oregon, May 7th, 2009, and I'd like to open a public hearing on 2794.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2794 requires health benefit plans to provide coverage of human papilloma virus vaccine for female beneficiaries who are 11 years of age or older. There is one amendment, which is in your packet.
And I'd like to call Representative Tomei and Senator Rosenbaum to forward. They've worked hard and long on this one. Okay.
Good morning. Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, I am Carolyn Tomei, state representative from Milwaukee and Southeast Portland, and I come to testify today in support of House Bill 2794. This bill would require insurance companies to cover the HPV vaccine for female beneficiaries who are 11 years of age or older. This is a great bill, as you mentioned, Chair, that we've been working on for some time, and it passed out of my Human Services Committee and comes to you with a bipartisan support from the House floor. It's also a legislative priority for the Oregon Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. This bill does not mandate that young women get the vaccine. It only ensures that insurance companies cover the vaccine if these young women so choose to get it. Although many insurance companies currently cover this vaccine, this bill will ensure that companies continue to cover it and that any insurer new to Oregon will also provide coverage. HPV has been shown to cause cervical cancer. Routine immunizations of young women against HPV will prevent approximately 70% of cervical cancers. And we have some statistics. There are 111 new cases of cervical cancer and 41 deaths per year in Oregon. And it's the most commonly sexually transmitted infection in the United States, with about 20 million people currently infected. Routine immunization of young women against HPV will prevent approximately 70% of cervical cancers. The mandatory coverage offered by this bill will ultimately ensure that girls and women have access to this preventive and effective immunization. And I want to thank the committee for hearing this important bill and to urge all of you to send this to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation.
Go ahead, and then we'll ask questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson and member of the committee. Good morning. And it's a great day in Oregon. It's also a great day to be able to hear and hopefully pass a great bill that will save lives of women in Oregon. Representative Tomei did an excellent job of covering what the bill does. I am pleased to be with her, the co-chair of the Women's Health and Wellness Alliance. I know, Madam Chair, that you are a former co-chair of that group and still an active participant. So House Bill 2794 is a big part of our agenda for this session, and we're very pleased that you're hearing it this morning. I just wanted to mention, you will have technical experts up here shortly that can answer any questions that you might have, but we had really compelling testimony for real people that are affected by this bill, from the Cancer Society, from the husband of a survivor of reproductive cancer. And we know you're busy, so we did not bring all that testimony this morning, but I hope that you will bear in mind that there are lots of real people out there that are affected every day by this bill and need the protection that it provides. We think it's a bill that really is about saving lives and preventing unnecessary suffering. There aren't too many opportunities you have to really prevent cancer. In fact, it's hard to think of another one where we've been able to have a vaccine that we know will prevent 80% of the cases of a particular cancer. So we think this is a great opportunity, and we're very pleased that you're hearing it today, and would be happy to answer any questions.
Well, we might call Lorraine up to Lorraine Duncan, but and she's the only other one. But
oh, and I'm sorry, I did forget one thing that we wanted to mention. There is an amendment to the bill, as was mentioned by the committee administrator, which simply caps the upper age limit at 26, which is the FDA recommendation for this vaccine, and we're fine with that.
And I'm very, go ahead, well, Senator Morissette. Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Does the insurance company object a little bit, a lot, or not at all?
We had no objections from the insurance company in our committee hearing, Senator. Excuse me, Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Morissette.
Okay, good. Well, in fact, I'm carrying two bills. I did one yesterday and one today that are quote-unquote mandates, but the insurance company actually supported one of them, and Blue Shield, who they do it in other parts of the country. This is on traumatic brain injury. The one today is smoking cessation, and they don't object to that one. So I think they're beginning to understand that it's cost-effective to do the preventative rather than have to pay the very high cost of covering people when they get very, very sick. So I congratulate them for seeing the light. I told them I wouldn't say, well, I'm going to say it, I wouldn't say insurance companies not only don't provide medical care, sometimes they stand in the way of it if they deny some of the critical tests and so on that people need, but I think that they have come around significantly. So, thank you.
What I'm wondering is, how are we going to get the word out regarding this? And maybe this is what the department will be able to tell us regarding letting parents as well as young women know about this vaccine.
I think that's a great question, Madam Chair. I do think they may address it. But also, there's been a really active campaign already of commercials, and I know the Lifetime Channel has done a great job trying to publicize this. I think they call it the One More campaign, or Not One More, or something like that. I can't remember exactly how it goes, but I'm sure the department can address that.
Excellent. And if I may also, I would assume that pediatricians, especially who are dealing with young girls, would also be aware of this and would encourage them to get this vaccine.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, Senator Bates.
Yeah, this is thank you for bringing this forward first. And this has been an especially troubling situation for physicians. If we had a vaccine that prevented 25% of leukemias in children, we would have a massive immunization program going on in our schools right now, but this has the S word attached to it, and as a result, we have a reservoir of a disease amongst us that we really can't get to. Frankly, this should be a vaccine for men and women across the board and eliminate this scourge in our society. Having said that, I'm glad to see this mandate coming forward, but I have one little concern. I wonder if it was a discussion in your committee or not. We have a growing number of people who are now in what we call self-insureds in our society. More people are in large companies like Intel and Fred Meyers and Nike, and now the PEBs. We've gone, PEB or not? OEB, I think, has gone. 100,000 lives are being taken out of the insurance we're talking about and going into self-insured. And under ERISA, we can't give them any mandates. Was there an opportunity to have a discussion about whether or not at least the state self-insureds would accept this as something they should be doing also? Was that part of your discussion?
It did come Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, it did come up in discussion, and it was made clear that it would not cover the self-insureds, although the state is covering the young women who are state insured.
And then, it's a huge hole. This is actually a public health issue, not just an issue of individuals, but a public health issue. And I would encourage PEB and OEB to actually step up and do the same thing we're asking everybody else to do. It's patently unfair, and it also leads to a public health issue that there will be a reservoir infection among public employees who can then cross infect other people. This is the same thing as polio, the same thing as smallpox, same thing as everything else we're dealing with in these vaccinations, and it's time we stopped hiding behind ERISA and got the job done. So I really appreciate you bringing it forward. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Just one question I have. Does this vaccine prevent an infection? And if so, why isn't it for men also?
Actually, that's a great question. I think it ideally, as Dr. Bates, Senator Bates said, it could be. So that's not what we're, I mean, the bill does not require that. But.
Madam Chair, there's a couple of issues yet to be resolved about that. One, it's the usual thing. The women pay the price. The guys have the fun. And it isn't a huge medical problem for men, but it is for women because it risks their lives. Cervical cancer is one of those preventable cancers we have in our society. The other thing is the cost. This vaccine is not cheap. To develop a vaccine of this nature and to give it is expensive. My memory of it, it's about $150 for both shots, if I remember correctly.
Exactly.
About $300, $150 per shot. It takes two injections. And you may find also when you get out there trying to give the shot, it kind of stings. And that's something that young ladies have a tendency to, you know, after they got their first shot, they don't want to come back for the second. I have their mothers dragging them back in for their second shot. But it really is a life-saving vaccine and one we need to go forward with.
I still say if it prevents, let's think next time around about having it covered for men also. We might be able to prevent this transmission. Yes, Senator Morissette.
A follow-up to Senator Bates' discussion of self-insured on the PEB board, ex officio advisory. And had this discussion with Joan Bouchard, who is the director of the board of PEB, about the change over at the end of this year. PEB will go self-insured at the end of this calendar year. And part of the discussion was over whether or not they would be covering some of these quote-unquote mandates that they're not required to. And I think they do, they have covered some, and they're open for discussion, and this is one of the things that I'm going to be talking about, because we can't mandate that they do, but they're concerned about wellness. This is something that I'm concerned about, and the wellness portion of PEB was dropped a couple of years ago, and this is a good opportunity to reinsert that, so we're having those discussions.
Good. Any other questions? Thank you very much, Lorraine Duncan. And are you in favor of the amendment?
Yes.
You did. Okay.
Yes.
And was Bess Slater supposed to be with you?
She's stuck in traffic.
Yeah. She'll be okay.
Chair Monis Anderson and committee, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Public Health Division. And I'd like to share the public health perspective around House Bill 2794. First, to give you a brief overview about the diseases and to talk about the vaccine, to tell you about the impact, which was also mentioned a little bit earlier, how it affects Oregonians, and what the immunization program has done to promote the HPV vaccine. So to start with, in 2006, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved for females 9 to 26 years of age the HPV vaccine. It prevents the majority of cervical cancer and genital warts. So it's recommended for females at 11 to 12 years of age, and they also encourage vaccination of 9 and 10-year-olds, and for those 13 through 26, but it's on the schedule for 11 to 12-year-olds. Many immunizations are given at that adolescent visit, the Tdap vaccine, the meningococcal vaccine, the HPV vaccine, and so Tdap is a new school requirement for this school year, so when 7th graders are going into their provider for services for Tdap, providers are doing a good job about talking to their family also about meningococcal vaccine and HPV vaccine. There's currently one vaccine that's licensed by the Food and Drug Administration. It's Gardasil. It's manufactured by Merck. There's a second HPV vaccine, Cervarix, which is in the process of getting licensed currently by GlaxoSmithKline. So the HPV vaccine prevents 70% of cervical cancers and 90% of genital warts. Females are still required to get an annual pap smear because this vaccine does not protect against all serotypes. So it's still important to be sure and have your pap smear. And as mentioned earlier, it's a three-dose series. It's pretty expensive, $130 a dose or $390 for a complete series of vaccine. Wanted to give you a little bit of overview about the impact, and I think most of this was already mentioned, but just to highlight, it's the 16th most common cancer among women in Oregon, the 4th most common cancer among Latino women. We had 111 new cases in 2005, which was included in the cancer registry, and it's the most current information that we have. 41 deaths, and 23,000 abnormal pap smears per year. So human papillomavirus has a huge impact on Oregon.
Is it the main cause of cervical cancer then?
Mm-hmm. I would also like to share with you, for females 9 to 18 years of age, we are able to cover that through the Vaccine for Children program. And public and private providers, are most 95% of the providers participate in that program, and so it's available in public and private clinics. Also, in public clinics, we cover underinsured and the folks that can't afford to pay their copay or their deductible on their insurance. The immunization program has been working hard since this vaccine was licensed to promote the vaccine and to make sure that it's being well utilized. We work with the Medicaid program to cover the folks that are 19 to 26 years old because the VFC program already covers all the Medicaid eligible children. And we worked to provide this toolkit for all providers, and it's been distributed to all Oregon providers doing immunization. And it's a reference guide with lots of information that they can share with their patients and also information that they can use for their practice. We monitor the uptake on vaccines through our statewide immunization registry called ALERT. And the fourth quarter of 2007, we had a 25% immunization rate for young females, and this is between 11 and 18 years of age. And by the third quarter of 2008, which is the most current data we have available, the vaccination rate is currently at 32%, so we still have a long way to go. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. Be happy to try to answer any of your questions.
And Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you. Lorraine, when does Gardasil go generic?
I haven't heard Senator Morris Anderson and Senator Cruz. I don't know that. Sorry.
Isn't it usually 20 years before?
It's usually a long time, and I haven't heard any discussion.
So how long has it been on the market now?
Or 2006.
2000, okay.
I still am wondering. I know men get genital herpes and genital warts also. Has the department ever talked about having a campaign that doesn't just focus on the women?
Chair Monis Anderson, currently the vaccine is only licensed for females. They're doing research so that they can prepare a vaccine that would be licensed for males. Currently isn't available, but I know they're working hard on that, and we hope that it would be available soon.
Great. That's good to know then. All right. There is an amendment, and the amendment states that insurance coverage would be from age 11 to 26. Do you have any comments on that?
The vaccine is recommended at 11 and 12-year-olds. It can be given as early as 9. We recommend it at 9. We forecast it in our statewide registry at 9. So many providers use our forecaster in the statewide registry because if somebody's coming in for a reason and they're there, we'd like to have them give it when they're there.
Okay, but this wouldn't cover it if they came in at age 9.
That's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
All right. I know that Beth Slater was supposed to testify. She's not here. She's in traffic from what I hear. And I can just close this, and when she gets here, we'll reopen it. Is there anyone else who would like to testify? I know that it was Kaiser who brought forward the amendment, but I don't see Ms. Deckert out there. Does she want to comment? Does she want to comment on the amendment as to... No? Okay. Great. It was pretty self-explanatory. All right. I will temporarily close 2794, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2133. Mr. Shook.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2133 eliminates statutory cap on fees charged for certain tests performed by state public health laboratories.
All right. And I think that Mr. Skiles is on the list. And he's the only one on the list.
Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson. For the record, I'm Mike Skiles, excuse me, and I'm the director of the State Public Health Laboratory in the Public Health Division of DHS. And we support this bill because it would allow our lab to, first of all, keep up with new and rapidly changing technologies that we cannot afford to offer under the existing caps. And also, it would allow us to make sure that some critically important services are available both to the state public health system and to medical labs that seek specialized reference testing and sometimes have to send these samples out of state and pay outrageous charges for them when we could, in fact, provide them in-state for quite a bit less. And I've given you written testimony that provides a lot of background about what we do in our lab, but I'm guessing you don't want me to read it to you, and that many of you are familiar with what we do anyway. But if I may, I'd like to just hit a couple of high points that relate to this bill. We do a wide range of things, including tests for many different communicable diseases, and especially those that are important in community health more than in individual health. And we also test for disorders of body chemistry in newborn infants under our regional metabolic screening program. Looking at the communicable disease testing, first of all, most of the samples that we get come from local health departments to test for things like sexually transmissible infections, TB, HIV, you know, viral hepatitis, norovirus, salmonella, and a lot of things like that. But we also do specialized kinds of testing that aren't available elsewhere, like rabies, botulism, and bioterrorism response for things like anthrax and so forth, and influenza, and more influenza and more influenza all the time, it seems, but and other kinds of unique and uncommon diseases that somebody needs to be able to test for, and that somebody is us. Now, medical labs in the state also have to send us, under state law, any cultures that they grow for certain kinds of organisms so they can be typed for epidemiologic purposes, either genetically typed or serologically typed or whatever, so that's another important role of ours as well. Now, we don't charge fees for much of this testing at all. I mean, the things that we do for local health departments, we provide either under categorical federal funds or under the small amount of general fund that we get. And so this would not be a big new burden for local health departments, even if we ended up raising fees for the kinds of tests that we do, because we don't charge them for much. However, there are some sort of niche tests, some things like pulsed field gel electrophoresis for typing enterics that private medical labs would like us to be able to offer, because they're paying $400 for a test that they have to send to Utah, whereas we could do it in our lab for $80 or $100, something like that. So that's one rationale for our being able to charge more than the existing caps allow, and that is just to bring in-state the ability to do some specialized kinds of testing.
How many tests are there like that? That where we send it out?
Well, there aren't a lot. There are a few what I would call low-frequency, high-intensity kinds of tests. And quite a lot of those tests have to do with the ability to recognize an epidemiologic pattern when it's occurring, or they have to do with somebody wanting to know if they have a methicillin-resistant staph aureus that's now become community-acquired instead of hospital-acquired, that sort of thing. I should just mention that a communicable disease testing accounts for about 40% of our budget, and as I said, almost all of that is federal and general, and relevant to your question, only a small percentage, like 1% of it, is actually funded by fees. So although this bill is really important to us to be able to expand the range of services that we offer, it's not huge in terms of budget impact by any stretch. The other 60% of our budget is from the fees we charge for newborn screening samples for the Northwest Regional Newborn Screening Program, which includes six states, one of which, of course, is Oregon. And this program is funded entirely by other funds' fee revenue. And we currently have a statutory cap for this. The technology is changing fast. The expectations are changing fast, in fact, much faster than we can keep up with the statutory cap increase. And so this has become a barrier for us in our ability to provide the newest kinds of testing for newborns. In addition...
So what would the fees, do you think... Are your costs being covered with the what you... What is it for a newborn screening?
Right now, the statutory cap is $30 per sample for newborn screening, and that includes testing for a little over 40 different disorders. And we're only charging $27, so we're not quite up to the cap. But we expect to have to increase that during this biennium, and we're not sure, frankly, that the other $3 is going to cover it. And in addition to that, we're going to be asked to adopt some new genetic testing and some things that we think are on the horizon that would require us to be right back here again asking for another statutory cap increase. And the time has come in our laboratory where our ability to just recover our costs for the things that we want to do is really in jeopardy as long as we have these caps in place. And so that's why we asked for this change.
Thank you. Yes, Senator Morsa.
In the communicable diseases, I see where you cover viral hepatitis. Is that hepatitis C?
Chair Monis-Anderson and Senator Morissette, there are several different types. There's type A, type B, type C, and a couple of others. Hepatitis C is, in fact, one of the things we can charge for, but it's an excellent example of one where I don't think we can recover our costs under the existing statutory cap.
Okay, follow up. I was getting to that. How expensive is hepatitis A and B are included in a physical exam test, blood test, for my doctor. That's part of the exam. Hep C is not. What's the cost of a hepatitis C?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Morissette, I'm sorry, I don't know what our actual cost is, and we have public health pricing that we provide to local health departments, for example, when they have a patient that they need to be tested, they need to test for hepatitis C. I'm going to have to find out and get back to you, but it's in the range of $15 or so, which is way, way less than you'd pay at a private laboratory, if I'm not mistaken.
And Mr. Chair, I believe when we were looking at adding Hep C to the HIV screen at that point, it was a few years ago, it was around 10 at that point, so.
Okay, so it's not
probably gone up a little bit.
Okay. If I may add, Chair Monis-Anderson, we charge our cost. You know, we're really, except for the testing that we do for other states where we're trying to make a little bit of profit to keep Oregon costs down, except for that, we're really just recovering our costs, and we are unable to do that under the caps that we have.
Madam Chair, does the cap and statute prevent you from charging other states more?
Chair Monis-Anderson, Senator Cruz, no. The statutory cap, as I understand it, is just for samples that we test in Oregon. And we have an interstate certificate under the federal CLIA law, and so we can do tests for labs and other entities out of state.
Madam Chair, this is a stellar organization. I've spoken about it before. It's amazing what they do. There are some things that happen in Oregon that I don't know how they come about. We test for five or six other states. The program has steadily grown over the last 15 years. It's been run efficiently, effectively. We've led the nation many times in new testing that was appropriate and necessary, especially for children. Metabolic disorders, saving people, kids and people from terrible diseases that produce mental retardation and other abnormalities. And I'm surprised to find we have these caps in place. If this doesn't make any sense to me. I don't think this is an organization that's going to get out of hand and suddenly start charging a lot of money. And if they do, quite frankly, there's other choices for hospitals and for physicians. But they've done such a stellar job that no one has questioned, and they've done it very inexpensively. It's amazingly inexpensively. I don't know how they've pulled it off at times. And they've restricted themselves to those diseases which have significance in the public domain and obviously have not got into areas in the private domain. They've done a great job. I think giving them a lifting of this cap is appropriate. I'm sure that if anything were to change in the future and they started charging excessively, the howls and screams would be heard very quickly. I think this is something we need to do and move it forward.
Thank you, Mr.
Well,
Senator Cruz.
I'm not a mess, so.
Oh, you called me Mr. earlier, so.
I did? Today?
Yes.
Oh, Lord. It's been a long day already. I don't necessarily have an issue, but just the philosophical perspective, I think the reason for caps in statute is to require an agency to come in and defend an increase before the Legislative Assembly. I like the flexibility in this. I guess I'm just wondering if, as long as they're reporting back to us on what the increase was and why, which isn't in legislation here. You know, not saying you're doing bad things, but just to still require you to defend a decision you have made for an increase, I think would be appropriate. And
Chairman Sanderson, may I respond? Thank you, Senator Cruz. That's a great point, and I appreciate you bringing it up. The manner in which we set our fees would not change if this bill passes. We would still go through the Senate Bill 333 process, and the legislature bats last on that one, so that we would get administrative approval during the interim if we raise fees, but then they still have to come to you for approval. And so we would not be just cut loose to charge whatever we want by any means. And the other thing I would like to say, and I want to say thank you, Senator Bates, for those kind comments. We have, in fact, been very judicious in raising our fees. The last fee increase in newborn screening was in 2002, and that's when we expanded from 6 disorders to 40. And the last time we raised our fees for communicable diseases was in 1998. And so we've really been careful about that, and we are accountable to the private sector laboratories. I mean, we're operating a publicly subsidized organization here, and there's no way that we are going to get in the business of competing with private labs for the business that they should have. So our intent is to stay focused on diseases of public health significance, but to be able to recover our costs, and that's what we're about.
Madam Chair, in no way are my comments to be construed as having anything but a praise for the work you do, because you do good work.
All right. No further discussion. There's no one else signed up to testify, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2133 and open a work session on House Bill 2133.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there... clerk will call the roll. Since
yes.
Senator Morse. Aye. Senator Morse.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chairman Sessions. Aye. Motion carries. And Senator Cruz, would you carry this fee bill?
Sure.
All right. With that, we'll close the work session on 2133. And open a public hearing on 2506.
Madam Chair,
quit smiling.
Madam Chair, House Bill 2506A requires health plans to cover services of professional counselors and marriage and family therapists if certain other services are covered by the plan.
All right. Oh, I just remember this bill. It was so agonizing, but I think we've got a great product now. With that, let's call Elizabeth Kushwa, Jeff Harmon, and Larry Connor up front.
Hi, yes.
Good morning, Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Kushwa, and I'm representing the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice. I'd like to thank you very much for your past support of our efforts. I'd like to tell you that the bill that you have before you today is a stronger, a leaner, a meaner bill than you've seen before. We took the direction that we received from the legislature very seriously in February, and we worked very closely with the psychologists and the alternative providers to craft a bill that applies only to licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists. I want to give a quick primer on the reason you have a -5 amendment before you. which may seem like there was a lot of fiddling on the other side, which is not the case. These were just little drafting issues all the way along the line. There was no opposition in the House to the bill at all. The Dash 5s came about after the House, the bill passed out of the House floor. Kaiser came to us, and they were concerned that due to the crafting of the statute that they needed to have your Dash 5s in Section 2. We've had talked to the Insurance Division, Teresa Miller. We've talked to attorneys. We feel that this does not change the meaning of the bill at all. This does not change the insurance statute at all. This is merely technical. Frankly, we don't feel that it's necessary, but if that's going to make everything move smoothly, we are more than happy to have the Dash 5s moved into the bill. Apparently, because the HMOs operate slightly differently than other insurance companies, we wanted to make that crystal clear. So I wanted to explain that to you quickly. The bill received unanimous support from House Human Services Committee, great support on the floor, including from people who voted against it last time. So we're feeling very confident that the bill that you have before you is a good piece of work. With that, I'll introduce Larry Connor.
Good morning. My name is Larry Connor. I'm a licensed professional counselor from Portland, and I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Coalition for Consumer Mental Health Protection and Choice in support of House Bill 2506A. Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, over a year ago, we were asked by a number of senators and representatives and the Oregon Psychological Association to write a practice act that would clearly define the practices of professional counseling and marriage and family therapy. House Bill 2506A is that practice act. I'd like to run quickly through the bill to point out some important content, and forgive me, but I'm going to bounce around a little bit and deal with different sections that are related in content, starting with Section 4. Section 4 includes updated definitions of the practices of professional counseling and marriage and family therapy. Those definitions update language to meet national standards of practice and education. Both are based on national definitions from our professional organizations. Sections 8, 13, and 14 together upgrade language and ensure that all licensees meet national standards for training and clinical experience in the diagnosis of mental disorders and practice in compliance with those standards, and require that they practice in compliance with those standards. We are deeply grateful for the repeated help and support that the Oregon Psychological Association gave us in developing the language of all these sections. Section 9 defines who needs to be licensed and who does not. An article was recently published in the Oregonian that said this bill, 2506A, was targeting all unlicensed counselors and therapists to force them to become licensed. That is not true. That they were assuming that this was the bill from last year, which was a title act. There are a number of persons practicing in Oregon who qualify for licensure as professional counselors or marriage and family therapists who are not licensed. This bill targets only those persons as licensed professional counselors and marriage and family therapists. If someone qualifies for licensure by having the required education and practices within the definitions that I mentioned in Section 4, we want that person to be licensed and to work under board oversight. Section 13 defines that those persons have until January 1st, 2011 to begin the process of becoming licensed. If someone does not have the education...
And how many do you think that will affect?
Chairman Mona Sanderson, we don't know.
Okay.
I would imagine 50 maybe, but that's a guess on my part.
And how many total licensed family therapists
do we have? We have over 2,000, 2,100, or roughly 2,100. If someone does not have the education required for licensure as a professional counselor or marriage and family therapist, or they do not practice as defined in Section 4, this bill does not apply to that person. He or she is free to continue to practice as they are doing right now. We are not interested in putting anyone out of work. We're only attempting to strengthen the oversight of our own. Section 9 also lists the following persons who are exempt from the licensure requirements of this bill. Those who are already licensed as mental health providers, such as psychologists and social workers, members of the clergy, employees of public or private agencies, and alcohol and drug counselors who are certified in Oregon, as well as the alternative providers that who do not qualify for licensure. There are several parts of this bill.
Where is that in the bill?
Section 9.
Section 9.
Oh, there.
Do you want
Section 13.
Line numbers?
No. Okay.
There are several parts of the bill that strengthen consumer protection. Two things that I've already alluded to: the requirement that all licensees meet current training and experience standards for diagnosis ensures safety for Oregon consumers, and the inclusion of all qualified doctors under board oversight ensures ethical practice for more providers. In Section 9 still, the bill addresses the issue that was raised several years ago in a series of Oregonian articles concerning a number of counselors and social workers who had lost their licenses due to sexual activity with clients and who were able to continue to practice as unlicensed counselors. The board was unable to stop them. With House Bill 2506A, the board will be empowered to issue substantial fines and injunctions to cease and desist. The practice definitions in Section 4 clearly differentiate the differences between the practices of professional counseling and marriage and family therapy on one side. We worked very hard to make this language very clear that it would differentiate us from those folks on the other side who are unlicensed, with the purpose that we are hoping that the legislature in the future will have, with that clear line of demarcation, will be able to set up a board, an additional board, that will provide oversight for all those who remain unlicensed, so that all consumers of mental health services in Oregon will know that they are working with someone who is board oversight, regardless of who they're seeing. House Bill 2506A requires group health benefit plans to provide coverage for services performed by a licensed professional counselor or a licensed marriage and family therapist when the plan covers licensed clinical social workers and nurse practitioners. All of the sections of the bill that have to do with insurance reimbursement, which includes Sections 2, 11, 12, and 16, merely add licensed professional counselors and licensed marriage and family therapists to current insurance statutes. There is no change in any content of insurance statutes. With the passage of House Bill 2506A, insurance carriers will be free to conduct business as they do currently. Thank you for inviting us to appear before you today. I want to thank you for your help and support for our prior legislative efforts and for this current bill. And I want to thank the Oregon Psychological Association and the multiple alternative providers we worked with who helped us develop the language of this bill. I want to thank members of the House who have supported and so generously passed this bill, especially each and every member of the House Human Services Committee. In conclusion, you can imagine that we have worked very hard on this bill for over a year. There are some of us on our committee who have worked on this effort year after year after year. Please pass this bill so that we can get back to work, so that we can get all of our energy focused on what we're good at, what we're trained to do, which is to provide professional and highly skilled clinical services to Oregonians from all walks of life and in all parts of this great state. Thank you.
The only comment I want is on page 6. Lines 5 through 8. We have this problem. This deals with the employees who are employed by state or federal agencies. We always have issues. It isn't just this group. It's with the social workers and it's with counseling. And so, hopefully we'll be able to convince our state and federal agencies to encourage their employees to become licensed. At this stage of the game, they didn't start out that way, and I would hope that that the state and federal agencies would really take heart and have these people licensed. Just a comment. All right.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Harmon. I'm a licensed professional counselor, and I practice in Joseph, Oregon, which is in Wallowa County, where we have 7,000 people and no traffic lights. So we're in a rural place.
I got a town.
And I'm here to talk with you about mental health issues that face rural communities in Oregon. Specifically, I want to talk with you about confidentiality, accessibility, and consumer protection. In Wallowa County, we have 2 licensed social workers, 3 licensed professional counselors, 1 social work intern, and 2 licensed professional counselor interns. We don't have any psychiatrists. We don't have any psychologists. Up until recently, I have been the only person in private practice in Wallowa County. So that meant there were really just 2 choices for care. If you wanted to get mental health care, you could come and schedule to work with me, or you can go to the Wallowa Valley Center for Wellness, which is the county's community mental health center. Now, the center provides good care, and I know that because I know all the folks there. I work there one day a week providing outpatient care. However, one of the problems that the center faces is an issue of privacy and confidentiality, because the mental health center exists for only one reason, and that's to take care of the mental health problems that are in the county. So that's the only reason you would go there. And when you go there, you go in the waiting room, and the waiting room usually has lots of people in it. So think about what it would be like to be a teacher, a police officer, a public official, a local administrator, a business person, members of their family. And now if you want to get care and use your health insurance, you want to have to go to the Center for Wellness. Well, to even get more specific to illustrate what the point is, think about being a teacher and you're there for whatever your issues are, and you sit across the room from one of your troubled students. Now your troubled student knows you're in there for mental health care. Think about being a police officer. You sit in there, and I can tell you one of the functions of the Center for Wellness is to do random UA tests. And so you're sitting in there with people that you've arrested, and they know now that you're in there. And not only that, it's not just that you're sitting in the room feeling uncomfortable, but then you have to deal with the issue about what happens if word gets out. What if my employer finds out that I'm getting mental health care, and what is that going to make my coworkers think about my effectiveness on the job? So it just creates a lot of issues, and it's too tough of a situation for most people to have to accommodate. So many times people will come to see me because they have an expectation that their treatment can be more confidential working with me. My office is located in a business section of Joseph. I'm surrounded by a bank, 2 art galleries, an electrical store, and a microbrewery. And we go to the microbrewery for care.
Good mental health.
Loosen up. When people go there, they park on the street. I'm the only person working out of my office. Nobody knows why anybody is in that part of town or what their business is. So they come there with an expectation that it can be more confidential. But they also come there with an expectation that the services they receive are professional. And the reason they think that is because they know I'm licensed by the state of Oregon. They know I've had to meet certain standards in order to get that license. But going along with that, they also have an expectation that they're going to be able to use their health insurance to help pay for that care. Some health insurance companies do pay for that care. For example, the Blue Cross plan that covers employees of the state of Oregon cover my services. However, the Blue Cross plan that covers the teachers where we live does not cover my services. So when I have to tell a client that my services are not covered, I always get the same kind of response pattern. Usually it's one of feeling frustrated or angry or surprised or disappointment. And then you can kind of see a shift into problem-solving mode as they start thinking, what are my options? What should I do now? Should I self-pay in order to continue care with me? They think to themselves, should I take a risk? Maybe I can make it work down at the Center for Wellness. Should I go without care? Or maybe I should stretch my care out and not get care as frequently as I need it, but it'll help me stretch out the cost for paying for that care. So for some people, they some people choose to cope or to self-pay and to stay in treatment with me, but you know what? It's not fair. It's not fair because these are their health insurance benefits. They come as a part of their compensation package, and I think that they ought to be able to use them. Also, another issue facing rural Oregon, or not rural Oregon, but in Wallowa County specifically, is that there are only two male therapists. I'm, of course, one of them. The other is Paul Spriggs Flanders. He is a licensed professional counselor, and he is the clinical director for the Center for Wellness. So if someone is a resident of Wallowa County and wants to use health insurance benefits to see a male therapist, Paul is the only choice. But Paul doesn't have a full-time caseload, and the reason is because he has administrative responsibilities as being the clinical director. So if you're not able to get in with Paul, then you have to think, okay, what's my next option? The next option is to drive to LeGrand, which is 75 miles away, or some people think about going up to Lewiston, Idaho, in order to get care. It's too far away. Doesn't make sense. Not conducive to getting good care. Several years ago, I had a client who was suicidal. And this person was well known in the community and was very terrified about confidentiality issues. And so made the decision to check into the hospital in Lewiston, Idaho. And in Wallowa County, this person didn't check into Wallowa Memorial Hospital. And Wallowa Memorial Hospital is a brand new state-of-the-art hospital, rural hospital. It's a model for rural Oregon. But the decision wasn't made to go there. The decision was made to go to Lewiston because of confidentiality issues. Upon discharge, the treatment plan called for ongoing outpatient care. And so this particular person scheduled to see me to get that care. I called, in this case, Blue Cross was the insurance company. I called Blue Cross and found out that my services were not going to be covered. So when I told that client that the services were not going to be covered, the decision was made that I'm not going to get care then. I'm just going to do the best that I can and hope for the best. So often when we talk about consumer protection, that was one of the things I said I wanted to talk about today. Often when we talk about consumer protection, we think about laws, rules, regulations, disclosure statements, ethics, things of that nature. But one of the things that I think often gets overlooked is when people who have health insurance benefits are put in the position to make a choice about whether they are going to get care, even if they're not able to use those health insurance benefits, it puts people at risk. I think it endangers people. In this particular case, this client was making a decision about whether to get ongoing care, and the consequences would have been possibly another costly hospitalization, or even worse yet, could have been suicide. Well, mental health problems just don't go away. You see them expressed or shifted, even the costs are shifted in other places. So, for example, employers will see on the job absenteeism, low productivity, and on the job injuries. And I know this firsthand because for the last 14 years I've had a manufacturing business and I've employed 25 employees. So I know exactly what I'm talking about when it comes to that. I had 25 employees up until the last few months. We don't have quite as many now. But the problems also manifest themselves in the schools. You'll see children that have untreated problems, and they have difficulty learning, and teachers are frustrated trying to figure out how to deal with them. Some individuals self-medicate by using illegal drugs or by abusing alcohol. Often, and I think this is the most common thing, is that clients will seek treatment from their primary care physician. In that situation, that's a good choice. I often recommend clients go see their primary care physician if I think medication is a good idea. But when you go to a primary care physician, generally the symptoms are treated through the use of medication, but there's no real addressing the underlying issues. That's something that just doesn't happen. But the cost got shifted. They didn't get used to pay for mental health care. They went to get to pay a primary care physician. So anyway, back to my story. I called Blue Cross back and explained that I thought that there was a risk for another hospitalization or for a possible suicide. whoever it was that I was working with at Blue Cross had the good judgment to issue a waiver and said, in this case, we're going to cover your services. So the client stayed in treatment for about 3 months. And I can tell you there's a good outcome. This client is back on the job. I see this person occasionally in the community. To the best of my knowledge, there's been no reoccurrence of the symptoms or the problems, and things are going well. But then I think to myself, what if I had talked with another Blue Cross representative? I talked with someone else, and Blue Cross decided to be rigid in its policies. What might have happened in this case? Privacy, confidentiality, and accessibility are not just issues faced by Willow County. They're issues for every rural county. In some counties, there aren't any providers except for licensed marriage and family therapists and licensed professional counselors. And in my written testimony, which I think you have a copy of, I've attached a map which shows where those shortages are. However, the issues faced by rural Oregon are in fact issues that are for every Oregonian, and House Bill 2506 fixes those problems because it makes sure that Oregonians have access to qualified mental health treatment providers. House Bill 2506 strengthens consumer protection for everyone. It does it by clearly defining the practice of professional counseling. It makes Oregon law more clear about the professional mental health services that consumers can count on because they know that these services have state oversight. The bill also makes certain that consumers who have health insurance never again have to be put in a position to decide about whether or not they can continue to get the care that they need or they have to take a chance on going without that care. More than that, House Bill 2506A increases the penalty fines that the Board of Licensed Professional Counselors and Therapists can impose. It raises it up to $2,500 for violations of rules and ethics. House Bill 2506 strengthens consumer protection for every Oregonian. It helps to increase access by making mental health care more affordable, especially in rural Oregon. And it does so without any fiscal impact to the state because it just allows people to use the benefits they already have. So for these reasons, I urge your support for House Bill 2506A.
Thank you very much. Any questions? All right. Thank you very much for coming. Good information. Laura Smith and Anna, I don't have my glasses. Ferrardi?
That's Laura Smith's testimony.
Oh.
She had to leave the Oregon Psychological.
Okay. Lori Queen has given us testimony for the record. She's representing the Oregon Psychological Association, and they have historically opposed all these efforts. And basically goes on to say that they now support House Bill 2506 as it represents a practice act which defines minimum standards of education and experiences in the diagnosis and treatment of mental orders. So please have that as part of the record.
Go ahead. Okay. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the committee, good morning. My name is Anna Berardi. I'm from George Fox University Tigard campus. I also have a private practice in Tigard, and I reside in Tigard as well. Thank you. This committee, members of this committee, have worked tirelessly on this bill in the past and in the present, so thank you. I appreciate your work. All of us do. I submit as testimony letters in support of House Bill 2506A from faculty members from various counseling and marriage and family therapy graduate programs from universities across the state of Oregon, and you will notice that many of those letters are signed by multiple members of these departments, which is a feat in and of itself, getting us all together. These letters attest that all of us train students to assess, diagnose, and treat mental disorders, and we require our graduates to demonstrate diagnostic competencies prior to the conferring of their degrees. Your work on this bill will eliminate employment barriers that our graduates experience by requiring the law to more clearly reflect the clinical responsibilities of LMFTs and LPCs. So again, I thank you for this bill. I think it is just important for all citizens of the state of Oregon. Are there any questions that I might be able to address for you?
Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate you.
You
coming down to testify. It's surprising that we don't. Laura Smith is the one who submitted the Oregon Psychological Association letter, and so we don't have the insurers. Is there? And I think they've all stepped out in the hall. Are there any insurers that would like to testify? Seeing none, there must not be any opposition. Okay, we do have the dash five, so we cannot pass it. We do not have the fiscal. So otherwise, I think we would have gone ahead. And so with that, if you just request the fiscal for the dash fives, and I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2506 and reopen a public hearing on HB 2794. Is Beth Slater here?
I really like they got 2506 finally under control. We really worked hard on this thing over. It's been a 4-year effort. It's important to bill for rural Oregon. It's
okay.
Important to me for everything.
What, the one we just
okay,
closed?
Go ahead. Chair Monis Anderson and members of the
it's
committee.
No problem,
for the record, my name is Beth Slater, and I'm representing Providence Health Systems. I apologize for not being here earlier. When
traffic, I hear.
I live in Senator Carter's district in North Portland, and I-5 is always full of surprises. So we worked on some amendments. The CDC recommends that women ages 11 to 26 with consideration for 9 and 10-year-olds get this vaccination. There are several clinical trials that have shown no added benefit for women over 26 to get this vaccine. We just wanted to add the upper age limit. The age 11 that's in there now was in there when we amended the bill. It was the way it was written. It was the way that Representative Tomei and Senator Rosenbaum had written it. So we just left that age because the lower age of 9 is more of a recommendation. It's sort of a consideration that those girls can get the vaccine, but it's recommended starting at age 11. So does that help?
Yes.
Do you need anything else from me?
We just want to make sure that the insurers got their statements on the record, and I appreciate you for driving down. Any other questions for Beth? Thanks so much for coming. Appreciate your input and the amendment, and we will be sending that to get a fiscal. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2794. We're not hearing 3234. Yes, I do. So with that, we're adjourned.